From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Well, they keep you at the gate. They don't let you in. They don't give you a press pass. If they let you in, they let you in late. If you get in, they don't call on you. If they call on you, they don't answer the question.
Russell McIver, editor of Corporate Crime Reporter, will describe what it's like to cover the White House, and we'll hear some of the questions.
Russell.
All right, two questions. UPI reported last week that Prime Minister Sharon of Israel has given the green light to Mossad, the Israeli intelligence service, to engage in targeted killings in the United States and other friendly countries. The report says Mossad has in the past engaged in assassinations in Belgium, Norway, and other European countries.
Also, we'll be speaking with Susan McDougall, the woman who wouldn't talk and refused to testify for Ken Starr. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. War Secretary Donald Rumsfeld enraged France and Germany yesterday by calling them old Europe and trying to isolate them for their anti-war stance. U.S. officials cited the Czech Republic, Poland, the Baltic states, Romania, and Bulgaria as likely allies. But Reuters Newswire reports Washington is increasingly isolated as China and Russia are lining up with U.S. allies France and Germany in opposing war. The London Guardian reports officials in Washington say Bush will lead the country into war with or without UN backing. Meanwhile, the New York Times is reporting top administration officials are now saying it's not the job of UN weapons inspectors to ferret out weapons or find a smoking gun. They say now that it's up to Iraq to turn over its weapons voluntarily. And Secretary of State General Colin Powell says he sees no need for further inspections. Bush is also losing support at home. The latest Times CBS poll reveals nearly two-thirds of Americans want President Bush to try to find a diplomatic solution to the Iraq situation. Less than a third say the U.S. should resort to military force. The poll also found Americans are twice as concerned about the economy as they are about either a pending war in Iraq or the war on terror. Half of Americans believe Bush doesn't share their priorities for the country, and almost 60% believe Bush's policies favor the rich. A majority of Americans, including almost half of Republicans, say reducing the deficit would be more likely to revive the economy than would cutting taxes. More than half oppose the centerpiece of Bush's tax cut plan, the elimination of a tax on corporate dividends. 54% of Americans support affirmative action in hiring, promoting, and college admissions. The majority of Americans support abortion rights, but respondents say they expect Bush to appoint justices to the Supreme Court who will vote to make abortion legal. The majority of Americans say the U.S. is less respected in the world today than it was 2 years ago when Bush took office. U.S. senators voted yesterday to block funding for the Total Information Awareness Program, headed by former National Security Advisor and felon John Poindexter. The Pentagon project would have tracked the phone calls, purchases, internet usage, reading material, and banking transactions of every American. Oregon Democrat Senator Ron Wyden introduced the measure. He told the New York Times the measure passed easily because dismayed Republican senators had told him, quote, "This is about the most far-reaching government surveillance proposal we have ever heard about." The measure states the computer dragnet cannot be deployed without congressional approval. The measure was tacked on to a spending package in the Senate, but it is not yet law. It is now expected to go to House and Senate negotiators. The Bush appointee to the Presidential Advisory Council on HIV and AIDS, Jerry Thacker, withdrew yesterday amid scathing criticism from Democrats and gay activists. The Washington Post reported yesterday on its front page that the Christian activist and Bob Jones University graduate has called AIDS the gay plague and characterized the, quote, sin of homosexuality as not a lifestyle but a, quote, death style. Thacker made these comments on various web pages that were recently removed from the internet. In his letter of withdrawal, Thacker did not deny these comments, but said they were taken out of context. A Bush administration commission studying reform to the famous Title IX Women's Scholarship Program is recommending allowing colleges and universities to limit the number of scholarships awarded to female athletes without regard to enrollment. Under the proposals obtained by the Washington Post, schools could devote as little as 43% of their athletic scholarships to women and still comply with the law, even though women comprise 55% of the enrollment in the nation's four-year colleges. Title IX is widely credited with increasing female participation in collegiate sports over the past 30 years. The Senate last night approved a $390 billion spending package. Republicans defeated Democratic moves to add billions of dollars for health care providers and job training programs, as well as for extensions on unemployment compensation for more than a million laid-off workers who've already exhausted all of their benefits. North and South Korea pledged today to work together to resolve the standoff over Pyongyang's nuclear programs peacefully. The week's cabinet-level meetings in Seoul were the first in months between the two Koreas. They agreed to hold a second round in April in Pyongyang. In a separate statement, the South Korean negotiators said they'd been unable to win any compromises from the North. The world's largest coffee company, Nestle, was forced into a humiliating U-turn last night after public outrage forced it to drop its $6 million claim against the famine-stricken Ethiopian government. The London Guardian first reported Nestle was demanding compensation over assets seized in the 1970s. Nestle was then deluged with 40,000 letters of protest. After talks with the Ethiopian government, Nestle settled for $1.5 million and will hand that money straight to the famine relief effort. Rival Ivory Coast factions united today behind a peace plan to end 4 months of bloody civil war. Under the plan, a coalition government will be established and urgent steps taken to ease ethnic strife. The plan will be ratified by a summit of West African leaders in Paris this weekend. In Venezuela, more than 500,000 Hugo Chavez supporters marched through the streets of Caracas. A 44-year-old homeless man was killed and 12 other people were injured when a homemade bomb exploded less than a block from the march. And the Reverend Al Sharpton's Harlem headquarters, after being destroyed 2 days ago by fire, is being dealt with now. City officials say the fire was caused by an electrical problem. The National Action Network headquarters had been a nerve center for civil rights in New York. Haitian immigrant Abner Louima, who was tortured by police, gave his first news conference there. The body of Amadou Diallo, the African immigrant killed by police in a hail of 41 bullets, was also viewed there. The Harlem headquarters caught on fire just after Al Sharpton put in the papers that he is establishing a presidential advisory committee.
Rulers of the nations, as you fuss and fight over who owns this or that and who has the right to design, build, sell, and store and fire all the bombs and guns to defend your holy empire. There are children hungry, children sick and dying. There are mothers, fathers, sisters, brothers crying. They're only pawns in your play of power and corruption. Slowly starve them, your new weapon of mass destruction. And prove to me, America, that you care. And prove to me, America, you're aware. Who's dying for your freedom in this land? Who pays the cost for the liberties you demand?
Is it for freedom? Sarah Thompson here on Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. With polls indicating that most Americans are opposed to war, you'd think there would be more questions that represented that point of view at the White House each day with the press briefings with Ari Fleischer. Occasionally, there are a few, and ones that represent all sorts of hard questions, like these. How many convicted criminals are on the White House staff? What was the president thinking when he appointed an alleged war criminal to investigate a war crime? Or, the president wants regime change in Iraq? Why don't you just say the president wants to overthrow the government in Iraq? Well, these are just a few of the questions that have been asked by Russell McIver, editor of Corporate Crime Reporter. He is co-author of the weekly Focus on the Corporation column, as well as putting out that weekly Corporate Crime Reporter, and joins us in our Firehouse studio today. Welcome to Democracy Now, Russell.
It's nice being here.
So what is it like to be at the White House, to ask the questions? How do you get in? Describe the whole scene.
Well, it's cold inside. How do you get in? You need a White House press pass. If you don't have that, you need a congressional press pass, which I have. But the White House finds ways to deny reporters who they don't like access. I found this out under the Clinton administration. The strategy the White House press people under Clinton was to say, okay, you can come in. And they would say they would clear you in, and then you would go to the Northwest Gate at the White House, and they would let you sit there and say, something's wrong with our computers. Yes, you're cleared in. They told you you're cleared in, but it's not registering, so something's going on. What the Clinton administration would do most often to keep me there, they leave me sitting there until there was like 10 minutes left in the press briefing. And then I would get in, and it would be impossible to get a question in. Gone are the days where you can shout and scream a la Sam Donaldson and get a question in. Now it's all very ordered. So that's one way they do it. They also just absolutely will deny reporters. They denied me for a number of months, saying, one woman at the press office said, Russell, don't you know that we're at war? And that was her explanation of why I couldn't get in. She said that it was a national security problem. It's been an ongoing battle.
She said
the reason I was being denied was because of national security. It's an ongoing battle, both under Clinton and Bush, to get access to the White House press briefing. Now, generally, I have access, but that's only because of the fuss that was made. So they'll deny you access. They'll keep you at the gate and not let you in until it's too late, or just not let you in, saying that there's some kind of computer glitch. If you get in, even though Ari says he goes in order of seating, if he doesn't want to ask in order, he'll just skip over you. After I asked the question about Elliot Abrams, why is Elliot Abrams a convicted criminal? I asked this three times in a row. Why is a convicted criminal allowed to be in a high policy position at the White House? Not only a convicted criminal, but a convicted criminal with rabid policies on the Middle East, in charge of Middle East policy at the White House. Why is he allowed? Why isn't being convicted of a crime a disqualifier for being in that kind of position? And each time he refused to answer the question. He didn't even say that Bush Sr. pardoned Elliot Abrams. That he didn't even come with that defense. He just absolutely refused to answer the question and got very upset the last time I asked it, saying I kept asking this question. The next time I went, there are like seven rows in the White House in the press area there. And the closer you get, the better chance you have, because he says he goes in order. In fact, if someone tries to ask a question out of order, he would say, we're going in order. So there I was in row four, good seat, and he skipped right over me.
Now, when you say they're going in order, because when I was there covering Clinton, the first rows had little gold plaques that you don't see if you just look at that White House press briefing room. Wall Street Journal, New York Times. You're not supposed to sit in those seats.
I think the first five rows are designated seats. And in fact, I think the news organizations pay for their seats. So you buy a seat at the White House. Now, what reporters try and do is sit in seats where reporters aren't showing up, which happens a lot. There are empty seats. But the first row are the networks. The second row are the major news weeklies and the major dailies. And then it goes from there. But you can get a seat in the fourth row. Sometimes you can get a seat in the third row. Sometimes when Helen Thomas isn't there, you can get a seat in the first row.
Does he call you Helen then?
He will say, what are you doing in Helen's seat?
Well, following up on the Elliot Abrams question, I'm looking at, and by the way, folks can see all of your questions at commondreams.org in the Ari and I section. And you ask, Ari, other than Elliot Abrams, how many convicted criminals are on the White House staff? Ari Fleischer responds, you tell me, Russell. You say, could you give a list of convicted criminals on the White House staff other than Elliot Abrams? Ari Fleischer responds, I'll go right to the convicted criminals division and ask them. You say, seriously, why isn't being convicted of a crime a disqualifier for being on the White House staff? And Ari Fleischer says, Russell, this is an issue that you like to repeat every briefing. You say, but you don't answer it, Ari. Ari Fleischer says, I refer you to the repeat that I gave you the third time you asked, which masked the second, which corresponded to the first. And you say, why isn't it a disqualifier? And he moves on.
Right. Now, so here's the thing. If, in fact, they have a security system, a very stringent security system at the White House, anybody who gets a job at the White House has to clear security. That means they check on your criminal record. This was a major white-collar crime. Elliot Abrams misled the Congress of the United States. He was pardoned by Bush Sr., but he's a convicted criminal who's been pardoned. So if they're letting convicted criminals take high policy positions, I think it's a legitimate question to ask, what other convicted criminals are there? And it's easy to know because they do the research. They know. They do the background checks before anybody gets a job at the White House. And yet, he totally dodges it. He thinks it's a question out of left field. He gets angry. He skips over me at the next briefing. So it's a way of Ari sending a message. If you try and pin him, if you actually try to get an answer, if you don't let it go, if you shake it until you say, look, this is the third time I want an answer to this, then he will say, I'm not going to call on you next time.
Now, the answer to that is another reporter echoing your question, not letting the White House spokesperson get away with not answering yours by each reporter asking that question or remaining silent so that you can continue to ask the question.
And that sometimes happened. Yesterday, there were a group of victims of medical malpractice in Washington, and they wanted to meet with the president. One woman was misdiagnosed with breast cancer. As a result, she had a double mastectomy. And under Bush's proposal, the damages she could get from the hospital and the doctor would be limited. And she was very upset by that. She came to Washington and she wanted to meet with the president. And I asked whether the president would meet with her and with the other victims of medical malpractice. Ari went into a rhetorical dance about what the president's position is on this, tort reform. Legal system out of control, and said they're not on the president's schedule today. But a reporter, just two after me, did follow up the question and was really concerned about this woman having. So there is follow up. There is sometimes follow up, but on the whole, there's not, and that's because reporters have their own questions they want to ask them.
Let's go to the question you most recently asked around the issue of SUVs.
Russell, two things. The president's auto safety chief, Dr. Jeffrey Runge, says that people who drive sports utility vehicles are especially vulnerable to fatal rollovers because the vehicle's high center of gravity makes them more likely to tip during sudden maneuvers. He says that if automakers don't make SUVs safer, the government should step in to mandate the changes. Does the president agree with Dr. Runge that sports utility vehicles are not safe enough and that consumers should think twice before buying one?
I think the president is guided on issues like this by the best expert analysis, and there are a variety of different analyses on this. I'm not clear that that's the prevailing view.
Auto safety chief, though.
It's one of the things he said. I'm not sure that's the only thing he said on this topic.
Question. A group of victims of medical malpractice are in town today to protest the president's proposed cap on medical malpractice damages. One, Linda McDougall, underwent a double mastectomy after being mistakenly told she had breast cancer. She said that President Bush wants to put through a cap on medical malpractice compensation. His intent is to harm me. The other, Kathy Olson, her son Stephen was severely brain damaged due to a medical error, and his compensation was drastically cut to a similar cap under California law. They want to meet with the president to present their views. Will the president meet with them?
Russell, the president's point of view on this is that people who are denied the medical services that they need and they deserve have every right to court. But the problem that we have in our society today is that right to court has been abused, not by cases for the people who are in need, but by lawyers who prey off of the cases of people who are not in need, to create a new system that has become such a lottery where people go to court and attempt to win millions, that what we have instead is a system where moms who are pregnant, who want to have babies, are losing the ability to go see a doctor. That's the other side of this story that the president is also focused on. The president wants to make sure that we have a legal system that works for the people who deserve help, and that's why the president's proposal does not call for caps in all regards.
This is Ari Fleischer answering the question asked by Russell McIver.
And it's total hospital industry propaganda. But this is typical Ari. If he has the propaganda at the tip of his tongue, he'll spout it for 5 minutes, not answer the question. But on the SUV question, he said about his own auto safety chief, I'm not clear that's the prevailing view. That's the administration's view published on the front page of the Wall Street Journal just a couple days ago where I got it. It's his own auto safety chief. And when I said, that's your own auto safety chief, he says that's one of the things he said. Well, that's the primary thing he said, that these cars are unsafe and consumers should think twice about buying them. And if the automakers don't act, we're going to act. So it was very, I think it was disconcerting that Ari backed away from his own auto safety.
We're talking to Russell McIver, editor of the Corporate Crime Reporter. His questions to Ari Fleischer, the White House spokesperson, can be found at commondreams.org. We're going to break and then come back to another question about assassination. Stay with us.
Once was asked Martin Luther King how the progress of rights could be so long coming. His answer was not the evil of some, but the silence of good people. We will not be silent. We will not be silent. We will not be silent. Although we may never arrive in the garden, sin is not in failure, but never starting. My silent friend is you that I'm speaking of.
We will not be silenced. Larry Shaw here on Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In a few minutes, we'll be joined by Susan McDougall, the woman who wouldn't talk. She went to jail and now has made the condition of women in prison her major issue as she speaks around the country. But we're talking to Russell McIver about what it's like to be a White House reporter. We heard your question on SUVs, Russell. Why don't reporters there ask more questions around the kind of attitude now in this country, people's feelings about war?
Well, from my own experience, it's unclear that reporters are being let in. People who want to ask those kinds of questions could be blocked. I mean, when I was denied from the White House for 2 months in 2001, they told me there was a war on, they told me it was national security, they told me I'd have to apply for a White House press pass to get in. I could no longer get on my congressional press pass. So I applied. They told me I'd hear within 30 days. I didn't hear after a year. And continuing, why not? Why am I applied? How come I'm not hearing? They say, you haven't met the criteria. What are the criteria? They refuse to give the criteria. That's another 4 months. Then they finally came through the criteria, and these are the criteria. You are the designated White House correspondent for your news organization, Corporate Crime Reporter. I am. You are credited by the House and Senate Press Gallery. I am. You are a resident of the Washington, D.C. area. I am. You are willing to undergo the required Secret Service background investigation. I am. And they say, I haven't met the criteria. They won't say which of those criteria I haven't met. Now, Robert Sherrill, who was the corporate crime reporter for The Nation for years, faced a similar problem back in the 70s. And he ended up suing the White House and going all the way to the Court of Appeals, which came down with a decision in his favor and forced the White House to let him back in and forced the White House to publish the real criteria so that they can't discriminate against reporters for any reason. And, you know, so I think the same kind of game is going on now. So when people say, and I get emails from all over the country from people suggesting questions, and I want to keep those coming. My email is russell@nationalpress.com. But when you say, how come more reporters aren't asking these questions, it's unclear to me that the White House is allowing access to all reporters who want to get in.
Well, let's take a listen to another of your questions, Russell McIver. Questions of the White House spokesperson, Ari Fleischer.
Russell. All right, two questions. UPI reported last week that Prime Minister Sharon of Israel has given the green light to Mossad, the Israeli intelligence service, to engage in targeted killings in the United States and other friendly countries. The report says Mossad has in the past engaged in assassinations in Belgium, Norway, and other European countries, but never in the United States. Is the administration aware of this policy, new Israeli policy, and has the administration agreed to it?
It's the first I've heard of it, so I have no comment to offer on it. I'll see if there's anything to the report.
You and the president have repeatedly said that Saddam Hussein gassed his own people. The biggest such attack was in Halabja in March 1988, where some 6,800 Kurds were killed. Last week, in an article in the International Herald Tribune, Joost Hilterman writes that while it was Iraq that carried out the attack, the United States at the time, fully aware that it was Iraq, accused Iran. This was apparently part of the tilt towards Iraq and the Iran-Iraq war. And the tilt included billions of dollars in loan guarantees. Sensing that he had carte blanche, Saddam escalated his resort to gas warfare and graduating to ever more lethal agents. So you and the president have said that Saddam has repeatedly gassed his own people. Why do you leave out the part that the United States, in effect, gave Saddam the green light?
Well, Russell, I speak for President George W. Bush in the year 2003. I think if you have a question about statements that were made or purportedly made by an administration in 1988, you need to address those to somewhere other than this White House. I can't speak for that. I don't know if that's accurate, inaccurate, but I think you have all the means to ask those questions yourself.
Russell McIver.
Well, two things on that. One, to quote Mark Russell, the comedian, we know Saddam has weapons of mass destruction. We have the receipts. And that's based on these news reports coming out that in the Washington Post and other news outlets that we, in fact, gave Saddam a lot of this stuff, number one. Number two, Ari says he speaks for President George Bush in the year 2003, but many of the people involved with the tilt towards Iraq in the 80s are in the current administration. Donald Rumsfeld went and met with Saddam, shook his hand, had a conversation. So it's pretty much the same gang, and it's disingenuous for Ari to say, hey, that was then, this is now.
You have also asked the question, as I quote at the top of the program, you say to Ari Fleischer, you've said the president wants regime change in Iraq, by which I take it to mean the president wants to overthrow the government in Iraq. Why don't you just say the president wants to overthrow the government in Iraq? Ari Fleischer says, Russell, I think you need to address your question to the hundreds of members of Congress who in 1998 voted for regime change as American policy under President Clinton, who signed it into law. And then you followed up.
Well, just because the Democrats, you know, and the Republicans got together and pushed through this bill doesn't mean it's the right thing or it's the right words. I mean, they want to overthrow Saddam. They should just come out and say, we want to overthrow Saddam.
What is the response of other reporters at this White House press briefing that takes place every day to you?
Reporters have political agendas, just like every other citizen in the United States. Some agree, some disagree. But it's, you know, for reporters to say, we are objective, we just want to ask the questions and get the information out to the American people, it's not believable. I mean, when you're in there, you realize some reporters want the president to go to war. They want him to, they're pushing him to go to war. They're asking leading questions. How come we're not going to war yet? You know, you say that there was a deadline and now you're letting it slide. Other reporters ask questions going the other way. So I think we have to admit that we are political human beings, reporters. We can't separate it out.
Anything else you'd like to add to give people a sense, since they often get to see Ari Fleischer on television, rarely get to hear the questions that are asked, what people should be thinking as they're hearing Ari Fleischer speak from your perspective in the fourth row or fifth row or sixth row, occasionally first row, if you can get
I've
an
never
empty
been,
seat.
No, I've never been up to the first row. I would say that, one, I'd call on reporters listening to the show to try and get access to the White House and get in there and ask questions from all sides. Two, I would say that send in questions. You know, I'm interested in hearing from people about kinds of questions they want to ask. Russell@nationalpress.com. And three, realize that it's a pressure cooker. And, you know, Ari's job is to keep information my view is Ari's job is to keep information as limited as possible. And so reporters are trying to get the information out. And it's not, there is some tough questioning, even from the front row. I think the tension between Ari and the national press, the network press, is rising. And there's real tension in that room now. And it's healthy tension, and it's got to continue.
Now, we're talking about the White House spokesperson. He supposedly speaks for the president. What about the number of press conferences he has had, the president of the United States,
yeah,
George
probably
Bush?
Fewer than any president in recent memory. And when he holds a press conference, then access is, you know, they tighten down even more. And I remember once someone, my handler at the White House, who I email every day, said, please clear me in. I emailed him, I said, please clear me in for the Ari briefing. He emails me back, you're cleared in. An hour later, he says, the briefing has been canceled, not informing me that a half hour later, the president was holding an impromptu press conference. So there are ways that that they can keep reporters out, especially when the president's holding a press briefing.
Well, it seems that the reason they want you to be cleared in every day is a reminder to you, without having the White House press pass, each day they get to choose whether
yes.
you're a part of
right.
the
and I think that if we go to war, that everybody in my position will be standing at the gate. That I'm sure that will be one option for them to say, okay, keep them at the gate and don't let them in.
Well, Russell Kiver, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Again, your email address for people who want to send you suggested questions.
Russell@nationalpress.com.
And by the way, I'll be on CNN today on Wolf Blitzer's Showdown Iraq at 12:30 Eastern Standard Time. If people want to send in suggested comments, you can send them to us at mail@democracynow.org. What do you feel a national TV viewing population should be hearing now? I'll be taking on Armstrong Williams and Wolf Blitzer. You are listening to Democracy Now! Helen Thomas, another person who is at the White House press briefings, has written in the introduction to the book we're going to talk about right now, The Woman Who Wouldn't Talk, Why I Refused to Testify Against the Clintons, and Why and What I Learned in Jail. It's a very powerful book. It was written with Pat Harris. The Washington Post recently wrote, it will forever be the question people ask her. Why? Why didn't Susan McDougal just answer the questions? Why on earth would anyone choose to spend 2 years in jail when all it took to be free was to provide a few simple incriminating sentences? The offer was there. The Office of the Independent Counsel, Kenneth Starr, would give her immunity from any charges related to the failed 1980s Whitewater real estate venture, in which she and her husband Jim McDougal were business partners with President Bill Clinton and Hillary Rodham Clinton, if only she would connect the Clintons to the deal. She said no, and she went to jail. The pictures are hard to forget. McDougal, on the day she went to prison, a woman in chains, taken away wearing black stockings, she served the maximum 18 months for civil contempt of court for her refusal to testify, and 3.5 months of a 2-year term for fraud in a 1996 Whitewater case brought by Starr's office. Her husband, also convicted of fraud, cooperated with the Starr investigation. He died of a heart attack while in prison. Today, we're going to talk with Susan McDougall and learn why she went to jail. She joins us in our studio. Welcome.
Good morning.
It's good to have you with us.
Thank you.
So when did it all start? What year?
We started being investigated in 1986, actually. And the Whitewater, I went to jail in 1996. So it was a really long road for us. In fact, Jim had gone to trial and been cleared of all charges until Clinton became president, and then they started the investigation again and charged him once more with kind of the same crimes. And they were more successful the second time around.
How did you get drawn into it?
I was basically drawn into it because I was married to him and because there were four people involved in the Whitewater venture: Bill and Hillary Clinton, and Jim and Susan McDougall. So there were four people who could answer the question as to what happened, you know, in the in the Whitewater land venture. Bill and Hillary weren't talking. Jim McDougall, although after he was convicted, began to cooperate with the independent counsel, they needed someone to back up his testimony. Jim was very erratic. At the time that he began to cooperate, he had already gone to the government and was receiving a check for being mentally ill, you know, too mentally ill to work. And so he was getting disability, and they needed someone to corroborate his statements. So I was the only one left at that point.
And talk about your first meeting with Ken Starr. Though you dealt with the prosecutors a great deal, you hardly ever actually met him.
No, I never met him. He tried once to shake my hand, and I just laughed at him and said, "I know you're kidding." But he always kept a distance, and I think that's something that people don't understand. He always had deniability of, you know, I wasn't the one who did that, or, you know, it wasn't my idea to do it. So I've never met with him, but with his assistant prosecutors. And at the very first meeting, I went in, just like any citizen would, thinking it was an investigation. They would ask me questions. I would see documents. I'm fully prepared to answer every question. And I remember the assistant independent counsel said, "That's not why we're here. We have a plan. We'd like you to give us testimony, a proffer against the Clintons, and for that, we will give you global immunity."
Proffer, what does it mean?
A proffer is like if you were a low-level drug dealer and you knew the big guy, you would give a proffer as to, this is the guy that sold me the drugs, here's his name, this is where he lives, and I'll testify against him. And they say to you, "Yeah, you're a little fish, you get to go home." So what they wanted me to do was implicate Bill or Hillary Clinton, say that they had done it all, they had orchestrated a crime, and then I would be given...
That crime being?
It's a long story, which is why I had to write a book, because people kept asking me. There was this municipal judge, a traffic judge in Little Rock, Arkansas, that had an SBA. It's a Small Business Administration loan office, and he'd been stealing millions of dollars. He'd been getting this money from the government, making up the names on the loans, and keeping the money for himself. He got raided. So he went to the U.S. attorney, and he said, "Listen, I can give you Bill Clinton if you'll give me immunity, and, you know, give me a lesser time in jail."
And he was?
David Hale.
David Hale, who Murray Wass and other reporters exposed.
Exactly. So David Hale came up with a story that Bill Clinton came to him during the presidential campaign and said, "I need $300,000 really badly. I can't borrow it. It's against election law. But my dupe, Susan McDougall, will come and get it and give it to me." And it was an absolute total lie from the beginning, but David Hale tried to work the system to get, you know, a lesser sentence. Well, the U.S. attorney didn't fall for it. He said, "You know, I've investigated this. I don't find any truth in it. You know, I don't believe it." And so he played the system until Kenneth Starr got appointed. Even the first independent prosecutor didn't believe the story, didn't follow that story. But when Kenneth Starr became prosecutor, he bought the David Hale story.
Talk about who Kenneth Starr is, and talk about Richard Mellon Scaife.
You know, I never followed the conspiracy that much. I was just trying to avoid being roadkill at the time, you know. There were other people who could speak better to it. But Richard Scaife is a right-wing multi-billionaire who hates Bill Clinton and funds all kinds of projects while Clinton is president to try to undermine his authority, to sully his name. And David Hale tied in to that money and he started receiving money from the SCAFE Foundation in order to keep this story going and in the press. And it had died several deaths. Nobody believed it. Kenneth Starr got appointed by a 3-judge panel. The original independent counsel got kicked out. It was all very underhanded and weird, but I still walked in the first day thinking, if I'm truthful and if I answer everything, everything will be all right.
So why did you choose not to answer their questions? Why did you go to jail?
It was very clear that the story David Hale was giving them was not true. One reason was that they had traced all of the money of the $300,000 and none of it had gone to Bill Clinton. And they had all the checks and all of the reasons to know that that story was untrue. But they wanted me to say that it was. They wanted me to say that that happened. And they had David Hale to say it. They had my ex-husband, whom they had threatened and had agreed to cooperate with them, and they really needed my testimony. And when I told them it wasn't true, and, you know, that's a story like, you don't have to wonder, did it happen? Did I do that? I mean, you know whether you did that or not. So I told them, I said, that just isn't true. It never happened. And that was the coercion. That's why I went to jail for 18 months, to coerce me. Sentence of civil contempt is not a definite sentence. It's a sentence of coercion. They put you in jail until they get what they want, and then you're released. So anytime I had said...
There's a cap on the time that they can hold you?
18 months.
How long were you held?
I was held the entire time.
We're going to break for stations to identify themselves. When we come back, we'll hear about your experiences in prison and why now you speak around the country on behalf of women in prison. We're talking to Susan McDougall. She has written the story of her life. It's called The Woman Who Wouldn't Talk. Stay with us.
Like a hole in the head, a prison is a home for the living dead. It is time for us to recognize that every man must be free if we really want to see eternity. Understanding that the spirit is a prime source of life that can only be stifled when put behind bars. We must all have an opportunity to shine like stars. Prisons like a hole in the head. Prisons create living dead. Prisons create living dead.
More prisons. Cool DJ EJ Feet, the last. Or Cool DJ EQ Feet, the last poets here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Our guest is Susan McDougall. Famous to many in this country for that photograph of her in shackles as she was taken off to jail. She joins us in our firehouse studio. So talk about the final day, the day you said no when they came to get you.
It was 2 days before my sentencing. They had convicted me, and I was talking with them because I was really afraid to go to jail. And even though I knew the story was untrue, I wanted to know if there was anything else I could do to save myself from having to be incarcerated. And the words that he said that day, he actually repeated later in my trial. He said,
"You
was
he?
I'm sorry, the independent counsel, the assistant independent counsel, Ray Yon. He said, you know who this investigation is about, and you know what we want. And for that, you can get probation and walk away today. That was 2 days before my sentencing. And at sentencing, they asked for 13 years because I refused to say that that story was true, because it was absolutely untrue. So I remember I called Pat Harris, who helped me write the book, and I said, Pat, all I have to do is say that this David Hale story is true, and my life can come back to me. You know, I can walk away today, and it can all be over. And he said, Susan, if you lie today, you'll be lying for the rest of your life. Every congressional hearing, every hearing you go into, every trial, everyone who ever asks you, did you tell the truth, you'll be lying until the day you die if you do this. And I I said, well, will you stand with me? And he said, yes. And so we decided that we would go, that I would go to jail and that he would help me get through it. And then, of course, I'd never even visited a jail at the time, scared to death. And I walked in the first jail, Faulkner County Detention Center in Conway, Arkansas. And there were 10, it was a 10-bed holding cell, a 10-bed jail. And there were probably 30 women sleeping head to toe, toe to head, around the one toilet, you know, up against walls, stepping over one another to go to the open bathroom. And it was really shocking, the conditions there. And the thing that I found that I wasn't expecting was how young these women were. I was usually the oldest woman in most of the jails where I went. And all of these young girls are mothers. Almost every one of them have children. And almost every one of them did not get through high school. They are uneducated. I had decided when I went to jail that what I would do was keep really separate, because I wasn't going to be like any of the people I met, you know. I was going to be so different that I couldn't possibly talk with them. And I was just going to keep myself safe and keep kind of separate. And I was so angry. I was so angry that I was in jail and I'd been wrongly convicted. So I was lying in my bed one day and I was going to read all these great books, and I'd taken them with me. And at this jail, they only allowed the Bible. That was only the King James Version of the Bible that they would allow in that jail. And I remember thinking, what am I going to do? You know, how am I going to get through this? And these women came to my bed and they said, would you read this to us? We can't read. And it changed my life. In that moment, I thought, I can't believe that. I can't believe these women cannot read. And so I got down on the floor with them, in the concrete floor, and I said, you know, how did you get here? Your faces are so innocent. You want to read the Bible. You know, they want so much to talk to someone who will understand them. The thing you find about jail is everybody comes in to preach and to talk and to tell them how they failed, what they ought to do, how they ought to be taught, but nobody wants to listen to them. They are really voices that are absolutely unheard and don't believe that they have any right to even speak. And so that is how I began. How did we get here?
But that was only one jail. You were in, what, seven?
Seven jails, five states.
Talk about the various levels of security. I mean, here you are in for a civil charge, a contempt charge. You served a year and a half for that, refusing to offer a proffer against the Clintons. Can you talk about sensory deprivation in the various jails?
It increasingly got harder. The longer I held out and would not cooperate, they had to increase the pressure because they had to have my testimony. And so I went from this place where it was open and I was treated like every other prisoner to a place they called the hardest woman's jail in America. It was Sybil Brand Institute in Los Angeles. And in that place...
So they flew you from Arkansas to Los Angeles.
That's right. And I actually went via a federal place, but I was only there for 3 weeks. They picked me up 2 days before Thanksgiving, transferred me, so I didn't get to see my family, you know, for days. They didn't know where I was. And then they transferred me again 3 weeks later, 2 days before Christmas, so my family also could not see me again, and I couldn't have any visits or, you know, have any kind of base, you know anybody at the jail. The moving is just horrifying when you're a prisoner. You're shackled, you're handcuffed, you're like that for hours. The moving in itself is a punishment.
Your hands shackled to your waist belt and your feet are shackled.
Yes. They'll hand you food. You're on a plane or on a bus or, you know, and they'll hand you food, but you can't get to it. Your hands are literally tied to your waist. You can't get a drink. You can't go to the bathroom. They won't even release one hand for you to go to the bathroom. So, you know, you're just, the move in itself is traumatic. You also don't know where you're going. Your family doesn't know where you are. And the one little, you know, pair of panties that you wash in the sink every day because they don't give you any, the comb that you keep, all of your belongings, your mailing list, you know, your family's addresses, they're taken. And you're literally taken with the clothes on your back. Mm-hmm. But at Sybil Brand, I remember they came to me before I was transferred and they said, you really need to think about what you're doing because you are about to go to the hardest women's jail in America. And at first, I thought, how much harder can it be, you know, than what it is? But they put me in what they called murderer's row. I was the only woman on that cell block that was not and
you
for murder.
In for a civil contempt of court charge.
Civil contempt. And on that row, most of the women were there for child murder. They had, you know, hurt their children or killed their children. And they wore what they called the red dress so that everyone seeing them would know that they had to be watched because the inmates would hurt them. And I wore the red dress as well. And when you walked down the hall, people would spit on you. They would call you names. You know, they hated all of these women who were in there, accused again, not convicted, but accused of child murder. And that was the block that I was put on in Sybil Brand, and also in lockdown in that block. Most of those women had access to television or to the exercise yard, but I was never allowed out of the cell except for an hour a day where I got a shower and a telephone call. And so I was on lockdown in a lockdown unit where the other people were not. And I kept thinking, why is everybody else out and getting privileges and I'm the one locked down?
Could you hear anything?
Oh, yeah. In that place, I could. So I began to meet the women there and hear their stories and start to, I started to be okay. The only thing there was I never got exercise. I never got out. I never saw the sun. I never saw, you know, got to go outside and do anything. And so that was the hardest part of that because I was locked in my cell all the time. But I was transferred from there to Twin Towers, and that was where I was put in the glass cell. That was just absolutely...
Twin Towers in Los Angeles.
If people came up to the glass and literally screamed as loud as they could, you could not hear them. It was a complete glass cell, and you could see inside, you know, 24 hours a day. But that also was on the mental wing of the Twin Towers section. And so I got to see a lot of what was going on with the mentally ill in that place. And that is really my deepest cause now, is what happens to the mentally ill in jail. People just can't even realize. They would don plastic suits and go in with hoses and wash the cells out of the feces and the urine. The women would be naked and screaming. I mean, it's like your worst nightmare of, you know, the 1800s asylums that we used to have. And I go now and visit jails, and they will tell you if I had twice as many cells to lock these women in, it would not be enough. And that is where we're putting our mentally ill women, because they're breaking the law. You know, they're out there and they get in trouble, and so they lock them in. So they're so emaciated because they don't even feed themselves. They're naked. The male guards come and bring their friends and watch the women as they're, you know, locked in there. It is the most amazing sight you have ever seen. They put plastic up along the bars so that the guards can walk by, because it's just so horrific to have to see it. I couldn't believe that I was in America when I was seeing all of that. But that was the great thing about being in seven jails. I got to see all of the different ways that people are treated. In the federal, the place I was for 3 weeks, also I was on the mental ward. They called it the Almond Joy Ward, because sometimes you feel like a nut, sometimes you don't. And those women were there for to be found whether or not they were mentally ill. And it was, again, people being beaten with telephones, sheets thrown over their heads, knocked against the wall, because the mentally ill do not follow directions. If you don't follow directions when you're in jail, you are going to get punished.
We're talking to Susan McDougall. She has written her story, The Woman Who Wouldn't Talk, Why I Refused to Testify Against the Clintons and What I Learned in Jail. For refusing to speak out against the Clintons, she served 18 months, the maximum someone can be put in jail for a contempt of court charge. Through this period, as you observe the different prisons, were you able to get information from the outside world about what was happening? We were certainly watching you paraded across the screen often enough in those 18 months.
In phone calls, you know, and in lawyer visits, I did find out. But the thing that I found really funny was I wasn't really interested. I had become so interested in what was happening in the jails and in the abuses of what was happening there, it really didn't interest me very much, to tell you the truth. I didn't follow, you know, the political side of it, because I was so horrified. I mean, in the time that I was in jail, 18 months, one juvenile screamed all night long for help and lost her child the next morning. Two women begged for medical attention and lost their children. The medical help there is not up to speed for women in jail. We're incarcerating huge numbers of women now because of these minimum sentencing laws, and they aren't ready for the problems, the unique problems of pregnancy and the health problems that women have. And so it is a desperate situation.
What about the difference between for-profit jails and others run by the state or the federal government?
Well, thank God I was never in a for-profit, because I've heard, you know, bad things about them. One of the reasons I think it might be hard is that even in the county-run jails where I was, you're hungry all the time. If you eat everything you get, all you think about is food. You go to bed hungry. You wake up hungry. Yeah. I used to have to grab the meal tray under the thing at Sybil Brand before the rats and the roaches could jump onto the food.
I just read the story of Wen Ho Lee in prison for 287 days. As they said, he was a spy, something the government could never prove. And it's one of the things he talked most about in prison and maximum security is how hungry he was, the Los Alamos scientist. You made a call to Ben Bradley at home.
I did.
Why? Ben Bradley,
I don't know that
the
he was at
editor
home.
Of the Washington Post.
He might have been at the Washington Post, but he had made a remark in the press about, you know, Kenneth Starr was a good guy. And I thought, my God, you know, this guy asked me to lie. I mean, he knew that it was a lie. He had all of the evidence to see that this story was untrue. But they wanted to go after Clinton. And here's this guy I thought so much of. I had always honored him for his work on the Watergate affair. So I called him. I said, how could you do that? How could you say that about this man? And he started to stutter. And he said, oh, I'm sorry. He said, you know, he's an attorney for the Washington Post. And he's a really good guy. He won a bunch of money for us in a lawsuit once or something. And I said, well, don't do that again. He said, yeah, I'll have to think more clearly before I say something like that. And he was very kind to me. And he sent me books, actually, in the jails where I could receive them. He was very nice. But, you know, I never got turned down for a collect phone call. I called people all over the country every time I'd get mad about something or wanted, you know, someone would write me a letter. I'd call them collect and say, collect from Susan McDougal, maximum security. And they'd go, oh, okay. And that always stunned me. People would talk to me all over the world.
Ken Starr went off to teach at Richard Mellon Scaife's Pepperdine University.
No, he got an offer to, and he was going to, and I thought, all right, here's my ticket. I'm out of here. Scaife's going to pay him off. He endowed a chair at Pepperdine. And Starr accepted it. He was going to go. And then all these wacko right-wing people said, no, I don't think you've tortured them enough. I really think you need to stay a little longer. And so he didn't go to Pepperdine. He stayed, and Monica Lewinsky came along. And so he got renewed vigor, the investigation started soaring, and poor Jim McDougal, who had sold his soul and decided to lie for leniency to get out of jail, got to sit there, and they totally reneged on every promise. They did not put him in a prison hospital. They did not care about him after they got Monica Lewinsky. And Jim died naked on the floor of a cell begging for his heart medication after they had promised him they would put him in a jail for his lies. And you know, I tell people, be very careful of who you make your deals with, as he made a deal with the devil, and he never will be able to take that back.
And finally, we only have 10 seconds, but your attitude to President Clinton today. He gave you a pardon on the last day.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did. I always said, if there's one person in the world that knows I'm innocent, it's Bill Clinton.
Susan McDougal, thanks for joining us. Her book is The Woman Who Wouldn't Talk, Why I Refused to Testify Against the Clintons and What I Learned in Jail. She wrote the book with Pat Harris, and that does it for the program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Anna Noguera, Alex Wolf, Mike DeFilippo as our engineer. And if you'd like to go to our website, it's www.democracynow.org. Susan McDougal in New York will be at Barnes & Noble at 7:30 tonight at 81st and Broadway. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
We need more prisons like a hole in the head. A prison is a home for the living dead. It is time for us to...